Please listen carefully.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the OMG Cyber Podcast, a cybersecurity podcast with a different perspective. And shock horror, no sponsor ads at all. That's right, no adverts, just chat, interviews, news, views, and clues about all things cybersecurity from yesteryear, today, and even the future. My name is Martin Overton and I will be your host. I have over 30 years of hands-on cybersecurity experience, including over 30 years of combating malware, that's worms, trojans, viruses, etc., and ransomware, over 15 years of doing ethical hacking, including social engineering, also known as hacking the human, and over 10 years doing digital forensics and incident response, from dealing with web defacements, cybercrime, right through to nation-state actors and APTs. As usual, you can get in contact with us via Twitter at @OMGCybersec, via our website at omgcybersecurity.co.uk, where you will find a contact form and actual telephone numbers, or you can leave us a message via the Anchor FM app. Please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts from, so that we know if you like what you hear, and if not, tell us how we can make it better. Apart from getting rid of the host, of course. Yes, this podcast is free, as in there's no adverts, etc. However, you can say thank you if you want to via the donation page on the site at omgcybersecurity.co.uk. Thank you to all of those that decide to do so. Coming up in this episode. So this episode is going to be somewhat different. Rather than the usual sections, apart from the housekeeping and the main section, really that's all there will be in this particular episode. Mainly because I've got a quite nice long interview with Ken Bechtel, and that's coming up shortly. Hello, housekeeping! Not much in the way of housekeeping this week. Just a big thank you to all of you that keep giving me very, very good feedback and comments. It's extremely welcome. Thank you very much. I also managed to complete the event last week in Newcastle for ITPS. Thank you very much to them for inviting me, and thank you very much for the audience for a warm reception and some excellent questions. Are you sitting comfortably? Do you have your popcorn? This is the main part of the show. Let's go. Today, we're going to be talking to Ken Bechtel. Ken, I've known for many, many, many years, far too many years than I care to remember. And we're going to talk about what I call the curious case of Conficker, the botnet that never bit. Okay, so Ken, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to do a quick introduction of yourself, where, how long you've been in cybersecurity, how you got interested in cybersecurity, and the sort of things you've done along the way?
Sure. Hi, Martin. Ken Bechtel here. Been doing computer security since 1984, when the Army decided that since I know how to program a computer, that I know how to secure it. found out about these things called computer viruses in 1988, started really digging into them because I figured them as a large-scale threat coming forward. And once I got out of the military, tried to figure out what to do with my life, and cybersecurity seemed to be a good rabbit hole to go down. It's been a long ride, long run. Supported large international corporations back in the early heyday of the worm threats, and been involved with every major malware outbreak since 1988. With the help of Martin and some other very fine folk, establishing Avian in the early days, the earliest threat sharing network. I like to consider that we kicked off the threat intelligence career field, as well as several other spinoffs from our malware and security research. And we definitely drove changes to the antivirus industry as well, with the major corporations not wanting to share what the indicators of compromises and how the malware was working. And we started sharing amongst ourselves, and next thing you know, the AV companies were beating down our door begging for our information. So,
indeed, that's right. I mean, interesting you say 1988. That was when I started as well. So that was my first introduction to Malcode. And yes, obviously we were involved with Avian. Yes, it's not a name you hear that often now, but it was, as you say, very much a pioneer in its day. We did actually lead the way, and you're quite right. We did actually basically come up with intelligence sharing, certainly around Malcode, for the first time. And it was all done through a non-commercial side of it. It was all done through sharing from individuals within large organizations and small organizations for no cost. I mean, I remember actually creating snort signatures and sharing them when we had new worms coming out. Things like, which ones did we have that came out? Loads of them. Can't think of that.
Go on. I mean, I think it was just you and I were cranking out snort signatures left, right, and center. Came up with that wonderful paper you wrote. What was that? Worm Charmer?
The Worm Charming, yes. Taking the SMB lure to the next level. Yes, yes. Yeah, so yeah, things like the Storm Worm, which were coming. And I was also finding lots and lots of copies of a banking Trojan family called OpperServe. And I actually had one of the very well respected security researchers from one of the very large antivirus companies. I won't mention them just to embarrass them. They actually phoned me up at one time and said, Martin, how are you catching these so fast? Are you actually writing them? And of course, the answer was no, I wasn't. Luckily, my honeypot, which was my SMB lure, was actually sitting there, happened to be with the first one. For some reason, it hit in Europe or pretty much anywhere in the world at that time, which was really, really quite unusual. So that was great fun. So yeah, that's great. Okay, so I wanted to talk a bit about Conficker in more detail. So, I mean, I wrote a paper or an article for Virus Bulletin back in March 2009, shortly after the Conficker B came out. And so there's a sort of intro here. It says, the last year or so have been rather quiet on the area of worms. Not since the likes of Nimdra and its offspring have we seen anything like the level of infections or disruption that a certain family of worms caused during the build-up to Christmas 2008 and well into the New Year celebrations of 2009. Now, I remember with Conficker myself that because I was actually running the forensics team for a large organization, and we were actually helping customers. We had a lot of paid up customers. And I was also the subject matter expert for Malcode for this particular large company, that I got a phone call during my Christmas holidays, which completely ruined the rest of my Christmas holidays and all my New Year celebrations, to help them out because they got hit by the brand new piece of Malcode. This time we didn't know it was called Conficker B. I was one of the first people actually in the world to see this new variant. And we captured a sample very quickly. But the first thing they knew is that they had a problem was when all their accounts on their Windows systems were being locked out. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, that's pretty much how I remember it. I mean, we were getting these reports that people are getting locked out of the machines, even admin accounts. And then the guys on the network side of the house were reporting a large amount of traffic going every which way, and it's like, okay, we got something nasty in the wire, and pretty much had to start digging deep.
Yeah,
came across that code, and I'm quite surprised by the amount of infection mechanisms that it had available to it.
Yeah, because it was one of what we've called one of the first, what we were calling then cocktail malware, wasn't it? So it was one that had multiple infection and propagation methods. I mean, I remember one of them, the original version of Conficker A actually used MS08067, which was a well-known exploit, but it also did other things as well. And the B version I thought was quite unusual because it was, well, I think the main thing different with the B version is, if I remember right, it was a DLL file, not an executable. In its true sense, so you had to load it through SVC host or some other method to actually get it to run.
Yeah, I believe you're correct in your memory. One of the things that really stood out to me was with the infection via USB, just using the auto run, we found out there were like 7 different ways you had to disable auto run. Is it an auto mounting CD? Is it a thumb drive? Is it a label that as a removable disk drive? There were like 7 different ways you had to disable auto run just to prevent it from loading up and going off.
Yeah, I actually remember looking at all the registry keys that had to be changed and actually creating a reg file that you could import to actually turn off all the relevant keys. It was as you say, it was quite horrendous just how many different ones there were there that had to be done. And of course, this forced Microsoft's hand to eventually turn off or disable auto run, but that took them quite a few years, if I remember right, to actually finally do it.
Yeah, it definitely was not overnight for sure.
Yeah, I think the other strange thing I remember about this is when I did a bit of digging into it, because I looked at one of the early samples. I mean, the good thing for most organizations at the time, this wasn't polymorphic, thank God. You know, it was a static binary, so it never changed, unlike some of the other code that we'd seen in the previous years, where each time it infected, it changed its way it looked and how it appeared on the hard drive or in memory, etc. This thing was static, which was great, which means it was relatively easy to write tools to detect it and to potentially block it, even using things like App Locker, for instance, on Windows. You could actually put in an MD5 hash into that and use that as a way to block it. But I also know that I remember looking at it when I looked at it. If you actually had a keyboard that was Ukrainian, it wouldn't infect you. So, you know, maybe that's a hint to where it was created by or who it was created by, somebody in Ukraine maybe. And also it knew that about virtual machines. So if you tried to run it in VMware, like most of us did at that time, to do analysis of it, you know, behavioral analysis or static analysis or, you know, reverse engineering it, it wouldn't run. It would just go to sleep.
Yeah, it was one of the first environmentally aware, which made me very glad that I was sitting old school and to a degree still am and have actual cast off iron machines sitting on the side that I can throw malware on, let them infect actual computers and see what they do about it. It does kind of slow down analysis with some of these newer ones that require to reach out to command and control, but at the same time, yeah. Configure was one of the first to be environmentally aware.
Yeah, and if I remember right as well, it also knew about certain sandboxes as well. So again, a typical trick that we used to use to actually run the malware to see what it did was to put it into a sandbox, let it run and look at all the output, all the calls it made, etc., all the changes it made to the system. This one apparently on quite a lot of sandboxes would actually refuse to run on a sandbox.
Yeah, I mean, this one was almost this one was pretty much a prelude to a lot of the modern malware that we're seeing. Seemingly almost professionally developed and Q&A'd even. So, you know, we didn't have as many as the bugs that you'd normally associate with malware. About the only thing that they could have done better besides the polymorphism, is to throttle back the network connections so that instead of being so boisterous on the network, hiding the lower traffic, which we're seeing a lot of now.
Yeah, and I think also if they hadn't have been quite so aggressive on trying to do a dictionary attack against the login accounts for each system it impacted, because if I remember right, I think it had a list of, I think it was over 250 passwords hard coded into the body of the malware, which it would try against each account it tried on an infected network.
The problem is a lot of those passwords that were encoded in it are still on the top 10 worst passwords that are in use.
What, you mean like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6?
Yeah. Password 1.
Yep. Yep. And I think, I mean, I was talking last week on the podcast on, I think it was episode 3, I was actually talking about password and talking about the NCSC's posting about the 100,000 top passwords that are most widely used. And guess what? As you quite rightly say, the same ones are there as they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, people just don't seem to learn. They need to understand that passwords are the new exploit nowadays.
I don't know. I mean, we've been preaching it for so long that it feels like it falls on deaf ears, because you look at the password list, as you said, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and compare it to the top 5 or 10 that was just done, you're not going to see much of a difference.
Nope.
You're going to see the same offenders. Now, granted, the deck chairs on the Titanic may have been changed a little, but they're still the same deck chairs.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, I mean, I'm a great believer in two-factor or multi-factor authentication where it's properly enabled. And I'm not talking about the likes of we've seen with the what we call password spraying. I'm sure you're aware of password spraying. We've been seeing the attacks against Office 365 where the bad guys have got all these stolen credentials, the user IDs or email addresses and passwords have been stolen from the many thousands of different breaches that have happened over the years and that are all been captured by Troy Hunt and all in the Have I Been Pwned database. And we know there's billions of these things. And that what's happened is the bad guys are taking these, as you know, and actually replaying them against Office 365 and Google G Suite. But people will say, oh, hang on, Martin, we're using two-factor authentication so they can't get in. And I say, well, that's fine, but have you still got IMAP switched on? Have you still got POP3 switched on? Because if you have, guess what? Those protocols don't use two-factor authentication and don't support it. And that's how they're getting into your accounts.
Indeed.
Anyway, so we've gone off a slight tangent there. No big surprise there. So one of the things I was going to talk about was it was also, config was quite unusual as well, if I remember right, because it also did an outbound request to things like getmyip.org and getmyip.co.uk, checkip.dns.org, to actually work out where in the world it actually was on the infected systems. And of course, as part of that, it actually built itself a botnet. So as a part of scanning around the network and infecting new systems, it was actually basically calling home to a command and control system. So we know at some point there was over a million of systems were compromised. And everybody was wondering, well, what the heck are they going to use this big botnet for? This is a huge botnet, but that time it's probably one of the biggest botnets we'd ever seen. I mean, what do you think about it?
There's a lot of speculation behind it, and what, you know, I don't think we're ever going to know the actual answer. There are a lot of good guesses. I mean, this could have been an R&D type project. Can this be done?
Yep.
Could have been set up for, and at the time there was a lot of speculation that it was being set up as a DDoS network so that they could take down whoever they didn't like. Specifically, are they going to target political protesters or dissidents, or are they going to target government websites that they don't like? There was a lot of speculation, and reality-wise, I don't know that we'll ever know the answer until we find out the actual author and what their intent was.
Yep, no,
I make a lot of good guesses, but
yeah, well, I'll be interested to hear some of the guesses. But yeah, I mean, I know that. I mean, like you, I believe that it was almost like a test run for something. And I think what actually happened is that the author was rather scared at the end of the day by the success of it and wanted to therefore keep their head down and make sure they couldn't be extradited to the US or wherever.
I think there's something to that. I mean, yeah, they were set up. They had the beautiful infrastructure. And even if it was a research project, can this be done? With that level of success, you generally do not walk away from it. So something must have scared the author or the host organization off of it. Maybe some some of the research activity into its origins, trying to track down who was doing the command and control. Maybe they got a little too close to the author, and that scared them enough into hiding, figuring, well, I don't want to go to jail for a long time.
Yeah, because I mean, if I think about this, you know, if I thought it was one of the big cybercrime syndicates out there, I don't think they would have walked away from it. I think they would have just gone and happily used it. I think you're right. You know, to me, it smacks more of a research project or somebody doing a proof of concept that got out of control, basically. They were, you know, victims of their own success, if you like.
Yeah. I mean, back, slight tangent, but back with Avian, if you remember, we were coming out with a malware researcher's code of conduct.
Yep.
And one of the very first items that we had put into that was do no harm, modeled after the Hippocratic Oath. If a legitimate researcher had let one of his lab creations get loose, at that time, ethically, they would have been very conflicted and, you know, they would have been shunned by the industry. These days, people probably shrug it off and say, it happened, don't let it happen again.
So you're almost suggesting in some ways it's a bit more like the Morris worm.
Yeah, in some aspects. Yeah.
That's another old one I can talk about at some point. However, just going back onto Config, one of the things that was quite unusual with it, if I remember correctly, was it actually had a packet filter capability in it. So if it saw outbound requests to a whole list of antivirus or security vendors' websites, it stopped the traffic.
Yeah, I believe that one had that in. I don't remember it directly, but there's been a couple that had that. And that was one aspect where me having like teamantivirus.org registered, we were able to bypass to a known clean that it wasn't scanning for.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, I mean, luckily it appears, yes, it was definitely in there. I mean, I'm just looking at the article I wrote for Virus Bulletin on Config at the time. There are a list of probably about 30 or 40, including Spamhouse, as well as big names like Rootkit, Rising, QuickHeal, PC Tools, Panda, Norman, Norton, Network Associates, Nod32, you know, all the names that you'd expect to see in there, you know, plus a load of the other ones. MCSoft, for instance, the one that's very good at writing decoders for a lot of the ransomware that's out at the moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's quite interesting what we saw there.
Yeah, I mean, rather circular, but I really feel this was one of the precursors of the modern malware that we're seeing.
Yep.
If you will, the bad guys learned a lot from it, and they've taken so much of the success of Conficker to leverage into more modern day things.
Yep. You can look at things like the Zeus Trojan botnets, all the other ones that are out there. There are lots of them. You can see a lot of similarities and a lot of things that, as you say, they picked up from the success of Conficker. They've tamed it down in certain areas, which some of the things we've already spoken about, things like the how aggressive it was and how noisy it was. That is, as you know now, very much today's malware is all about let's stay quiet unless we're ransomware.
Yeah, I mean, today's stuff, they're trying low-key. Because again, that was one of the big triggers back in the day. You knew something bad was happening by the amount of traffic. Another case of that was like Love Letter, which was a Visual Basic script.
Yep.
Traversing the email, and you're having reams of paper coming out of fax machines and printers that were hooked up to the network.
Yeah, and we've only just had the 19th anniversary of that on May the 4th.
That was a fun couple of days.
Well, you know, as you know, it's known as two things. For most people, it's known as the Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. And for us, our malware geeks, we know it as Love Letter Day. Or the I Love You Worm, or yes. Love Bug, whichever name you want to give it. Yeah. All good fun.
And for guys like you and I that were in the middle of that, we can all tell you exactly where we were and what we were doing when it hit.
Indeed, yes. And those are the days where you could actually remember the names of every piece of mail code you saw. And yes. Nowadays, we're talking, what, hundreds of thousands, if not 500,000 plus samples per day, or millions, depending on how you count them. So it's impossible nowadays.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but.
So if you had one piece of advice to people, you know, looking back at things like Conficker, to say to people, well, look, this is what you need to learn from it. What would it be?
Well, first off, don't think that because it's over a decade old that it's not going away. I mean, we're still seeing it in the network traffic that it's still out there. It's still significantly present.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think I've actually seen stats anything up to 10% of the internet is infected at any one time by Conficker. Bear in mind that it's more than a decade old now. It's still out there, and we still see lots of other malware, as you quite rightly say. We're still seeing old malware. It doesn't really truly die unless the platform it lived on completely dies.
Exactly. And even then, it's not dead. It's more dormant than dead. Working with a couple of antivirus firms and developers, the thing I keep hearing from them, well, let's cut out these old DOS viruses because nobody's going to see them anymore. And I keep reminding them, hey, look, 2003, I had somebody give me a box of 5 1/4-inch discs with Michelangelo on it. It was sitting in somebody's closet.
Yep.
It's still out there. Yep. They don't go away.
Nope. I mean, I even remember when I did a paper for Virus Bulletin, I think it was the 2007 conference, which was, I think, was in, was it 2007? No. I'm trying to remember when it was. Anyway, I remember doing a paper for Virus Bulletin for one of the conferences where I was actually testing old boot sectors against NT. And it was horrifying just how many would actually work under the NT kernel still, even though some of the functionality wouldn't work. I remember even things like form, that would still work. It would still infect the boot sector, and after 600 reboots, it would do whatever its payload would still trigger.
Well, I was going to do a paper for the security conference circuits last year. 2 years ago, all my career is a circle.
Yep.
Everything that was old is new.
Yep.
Boot sector infectors are now, what is it, zone zero infector. Memory resident long-term TSR infectors are now APT. They're just rebranding it.
Yep.
They may bring in some of the new technology and maybe new exploits, but reality, we had polymorphics back in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about things like Whale.
Yeah.
I mean, that was not only was it highly polymorphic, it was extremely heavily armored too. I mean, it was the most amazing piece of code.
I mean... The bad guys aren't stupid. They look at what was successful in the past. They look at things like Conficker, and then they tweak it to make it less detectable. They test it against all the malware or counter malware stuff that they can get their hands on, including some of this artificial intelligence stuff and machine learning. Machine learning, we used to call that... rules-based.
Yep, or heuristics.
Heuristics. So, you know, it's a lot of the stuff that we're seeing is just slapping a new label on an old threat.
Indeed. So
just because the threat's old doesn't make it irrelevant.
No, and we quite frequently say, I mean, I always say to people whenever I talk to them, you know, at all levels, you know, just if you want to learn what's coming, look back at the past, because we see a lot of the old techniques being dusted off, retooled slightly, and then relaunched for a new set of victims that basically don't know about it. So, I mean, ransomware is a perfect example. You know as well as I do, the first ransomware, 1989, on a floppy disk through the post, right? Most people think that ransomware is new.
I was quite happy that I was still in the Republic of Korea at that time and never did get the diskette. It wasn't until years later that I got a copy of it.
I've got a copy the same year it was released. I've actually got a copy sitting in my cupboard behind me right now, along with a whole load of, you say about discs, you know, 5 1/4-inch discs full of things like Stoned, Form, whatever, all of those ones. I've got all of them. Yeah, I've got a massive kazoo of old mail code. It's great. I don't got anything that can run on anymore, because although I have still got things like 5 1/4-inch and 3 1/2-inch drives sitting in a box underneath my desk, which I could put into an old chassis at some point and boot up maybe.
I've actually got some 386. I've even got an IBM PS2 sitting over there on the shelf.
Which model?
I can't say that for certain.
A 50? A 50 or a 30 or a 70 or a 60?
I want to say it was a 30, but
I'm not. 30 was the very narrow one, desktop one. Yeah, that was a 30, or there was I think there was also a 25 as well. So showing our age now. But they were the first modern IBM computers that had hard drives in.
But, I mean, I find it good to have those old irons sitting around, those old hard machines. Will we ever use them again? Probably not. But, I don't know. I like having them there. It's a comforting factor knowing that if something weird and offbeat comes up, I can address it.
Yeah, I've actually just remembered I've actually got a fully working Toshiba Satellite Pro sitting in my cupboard as well, still completely functional, and I actually used to use it as part of one of my honeypots because it was that good.
There's some good machines that are still out there that are still running that today we would laugh at.
Yep. Indeed. So that's been great. Right. So what else do we want to talk about? Do you want me to pass your details on to everybody?
I have no objection to that, Martin.
Okay. So if you want to send them to me via email, I'll add them to the show notes, because I'll obviously include this interview into the show. And I just want to say thank you very much, Ken. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you as always. I miss actually meeting you at places like Virus Bulletin conferences, which I haven't been to for quite a number of years, and even though this year it's going to be in London, I'm not going to get there, even though I submitted a paper.
I don't know I'll get there at this rate. Here's hoping.
Yep.
But yeah, I definitely miss our chats in the after, outside the venues and at the pubs, and the camaraderie ship that used to pervade the antivirus industry. It was quite a small select group and good people all.
Yep, indeed. And I still keep in contact with quite a few of them, usually very ad hoc, and tend to bump into them, or just we email each other out of the blue. So, yep, my door's always open, Ken. Feel free to reach out to me on Skype. I will be here. Thank you very much again. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Martin. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It was fun.
Indeed. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Let me know what you think. Do you actually like this format? Do you prefer the more standard format? Or would you like to see some form of hybrid? And obviously, if you'd like to be a guest and you have something you feel that you'd like to share and discuss with me, feel free to reach out to me. Thank you. Well, that's all, folks, for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, or at least found it useful. please leave a review on whichever podcast platform you use, as it does help others to find us. Thank you in advance. Stay safe out there. Ta-ta for now.